my wrestling and in my doubts, in my failures, you won't walk out. Your great love will lead me through. You are the peace in my troubled sea. Whoa, you are the peace in my troubled sea.
Yeah. I'm so glad you're here. Let's continue our journey through the second half of Book 2, shall we? With just a few words on Psalms 56 to 72, why don't we make a comment or two on each one so that when we come to our workshop questions, we'll be able to have a full orientation to the second part of Book 2 and be able to respond accordingly to our various workshop questions. Getting straight into the material then, let's have a look at Psalm 56 that starts with an interesting heading. The superscription, after kind of some musical notes about the dove on the distant oaks. We're told, of course, that the director of music ought to take this seriously as a David composition, so you can imagine a certain musical tune, and I trust as you've been reading through the various psalms with the ascription of David, you've been kind of composing melodies in your mind or extrapolating what these might sound like when they're in a sort of a temple performance. One of the advantages, of course, of the Jerusalem Temple is you can have the hottest, the best bands in the land to come and to perform week after week in the Jerusalem Temple, and you've got the resources and the centrality to be able to do that. All that's well and good. The interesting part of the superscription is, this one says, when the Philistines had seized him in Gath. Now, there's a couple of peregrinations that David makes, a couple of ventures into Philistine territory in chapters 21, for example, and then again in chapter 27, although neither says that David's actually seized, that is, arrested, handcuffed, and taken into captivity, as is suggested in this psalm. So it's curious, either this event isn't recorded in the canonical book of 1 Samuel, and that's possible, or the heading is inviting the worshiping community to provide sort of a template or an inspiration for how to pray in a kind of situation that you might be in that resembles that, when a high-tech foreign power takes you captive or seizes you or seizes your hope or does something with a predicament that's much like the one that you can envision in David's fugitive days in 1 Samuel. No surprise, when we're talking about handcuffs or handcuffed hope, when I'm afraid, I'll trust in you. In God, whose word I praise, in God I will trust, I won't be afraid. What can humanity do to me? That seems to be the centerpiece of Psalm 56. And it might be more relevant than we think in Book 2, because there's a number of kings who were taken into custody by overlords in 2 Kings. And one would hope that, of course, the kings are forced to rely on the shepherd of Israel in new ways. So as we're here in the heart of Book 2 now, what we have in Psalm 56 is perhaps a throwback, kind of a retro throwback to an earlier period, to imagine a kind of imprisonment or an episode of acute suffering. Don't forget the name David means the beloved one. So in a lot of ways, the Davidic experience represents anyone in the believing community who can have these kinds of experiences. And indeed, we seem to be in kind of a series of these retro psalms as Psalm 57 takes us deep into the cave, when David had fled from Saul into the cave. The poet of Psalm 57 cries out, I'm in the midst of lions, I lie among ravenous beasts, men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Did you notice again I'm reverting to the NIV 1984 translation? I think you'd want to say human beings whose teeth are spears and arrows, because there's shows out there like Mean Girls, and it seems to me there's a lot of spears, arrows, and sharp swords that are being traded in that kind of programming. Again, the cave is during David's fugitive period when he's on the run from the manic King Saul, who's thrown spears at his head, and who's also his father-in-law. So if you're struggling with your father-in-law, I think you can take comfort from the Davidic experience and say, you know, it's not that bad. If, again, it's during this fugitive period and the cave evokes memories of David, of course, hiding from Saul, then who are the lions You know, they may well be his own men who were tempting him to destroy Saul. And of course, what does David say? Never send out your hand against the Lord's anointed. Even if you have him in a vulnerable position in an outhouse, you do not take him out. And of course, it's curious that he's speaking to his own men, and David himself is the Lord's anointed and will be the future king. And that may well be a rebuke that, you know what, when I'm in a vulnerable place, I don't expect you to stab me quite literally in the back. Here's the poet then, who's on the run because of evil and is surrounded by evil. That's a kind of claustrophobic type of situation. So yes, this characterizes David's experience, but it also comments on, say, the last 50 years of Judah's history, with increasing external tensions and internal factions that are dividing the nation against itself. And yet the poet of Psalm 57 declares, "I will awake the dawn, I will give thanks to you, O Lord among the peoples, and I'll sing praises to you among the nations." Just give me a second to pull out the Hebrew text of Psalm 58, because it seems to start in a controversial fashion. The NIV: "Do you rulers indeed speak justly? Do you judge uprightly among men? No. In your heart you devise injustice, and your hands mete out violence on the earth." The interesting thing about the text of Psalm 58 is that the word Elohim is used. Now, that could mean to wicked human beings behaving arrogantly, and we have a line like that in Ezekiel 17, or something not dissimilar in 2 Kings 24. But more likely is probably heavenly beings here, Elohim, these numinous figures who rebelled against God's absolute authority and then subsequently incite humans to act wickedly. So really, this is a panoply of evil gods who then sponsor deviant human practices. You know, it would seem to me this is almost spiritual warfare here in Psalm 58. And yet the psalm concludes on a most powerful note: surely there is a God who judges the earth. So I find that a great poetic kind of inclusio at the end. You have a God, an Elohim, who will judge all the other Elohims who've been weighed and who've been found wanting. Turning now to Psalm 59, once again we have a Davidic superscription with an episode directly from the life of David. This one takes place, quote, "when Saul had sent men to watch David's house in order to kill him." This, of course, is 1 Samuel 19, when David's first wife, and I'm having to pause there, remember he has probably several dozen by the end of it, but his first wife is Michelle. She has a rock star poster of David in her room, loves him greatly. In fact, the only place in Hebrew narrative where a woman loves a man is Michelle loving David. And indeed, she sides with him over and against her father. And like a bad Clint Eastwood movie, she makes kind of a dummy in the bed and says he's not feeling well and allows him to escape through the window. And he never comes back for her. And they kind of end up, last time we see them together in 2 Samuel 6, having a bit of a tiff. It's not so much the wedding song of David and Michelle that's in the poet's mind here in Psalm 59, but rather the situation of attack. You see, God preserved David from great peril. God then made a promise to David. And by extension, I'm almost getting kind of a syllogism here, so God will preserve the promise to David in times of comparable peril. Did we follow that? Feel free to rewind if not, but it's really interesting. David's life was on the line when Saul's agents were ordered to execute him, and yet God maneuvered the circumstances whereby David is protected. Now, here in Book 2, if it reflects the second part of the monarchy, if it reflects the turbulence of the books of Kings, what we know is that there are a number of situations where nations are surrounding the city, laying siege like a pack of rabid dogs. But God will not allow that promise to be finally destroyed. So just like God protected the person, so God will protect the promise. And by extension, those who are under the aegis of the promise will continue to benefit both them and in future posterity, so to speak. look for a moment at the superscription of Psalm 60 and tell me, if you don't mind, what jumps out at you. Yes, I was thinking the same thing. Joab makes the Book of Psalms. My goodness, the Book of Common Prayer itself, the original. 150 greatest hits, and who do you find in a superscription here in Book 2? But Joab. You know, there's some anti-Joab commentators out there. What I've noticed at Briarcrest is folks have a bit of a soft spot for him, at least some people. Joab is the one military commander who doesn't seem to have aspirations for the throne of Israel himself. Of course, he's self-interested. And of course, he murders people in the back alley. Of course, he does a whole bunch of things of questionable legality, and does so to preserve David's strength on the throne. Now, again, I admit that's self-interest, but at least he's not trying to manipulate his way on to the throne of Israel. And I suppose, you know, given the low bar that we have in the books of Samuel and Kings, that has got to be seen as commendable. Whether you totally reject that reading or not, my feelings aren't hurt, don't worry. But I just find it interesting that Joab is here, and here's a psalm that kind of takes place outside of the land. My goodness. Book 3, there's going to be a lot of prayers that take place outside the land, so you wonder if this isn't priming the pump just a little bit. Two quick things. You know, sometimes God allowed victories on foreign soil in order to preserve the safety of the nation. In times of captivity, God's can likewise allow the people to survive on foreign soil. So you wonder if this isn't a bit of an anticipatory, kind of a worship song you'd hear in the temple, and it's reminding you to teach something to your kids, to pass on to their kids, about how even memories of old military victories can be presented as a call to trust in God in times of military defeat and the corresponding uncertainty that comes from it. So, interesting memories preserved in Psalm 60 with the people outside the land and God allowing a victory on the foreign soil, reminding us that God will enable people to survive even in hostile foreign locations in the future. As we turn to Psalm 61, I've got a question for you. Hear my cry, O God, listen to my prayer. Here's my question. From the ends of the earth, I call to you. I call as my heart grows faint. Lead me to the rock that's higher than I. From the ends of the earth, I call to you. Is that literal? Meaning, is the poet like somewhere far away? Or does the poet just sort of feel alienated? Or, you know, sometimes you can be in the midst of the worshiping community, but you might as well be in Babylonian exile or the Maritimes or somewhere. I mean, I get that, but yeah, you do wonder. We just had Psalm 60 taking place outside the land. From the ends of the earth, I call to you. Lead me to the rock that's higher than I. I want to worship in the sanctuary. I want to be in the tent under the wings of the cherubim who guard the Ark of the Covenant. Extend protection even when I'm far away. I mean, Solomon did pray that in 1 Kings 8, when you scatter us. Perhaps we can turn toward Jerusalem and, you know, you'll hear us. Or is this a faithful soldier who's on the battlefield and just hoping to get home, right? I mean, if we've got thousands of Israelite soldiers in a foreign place trying to protect the safety of the nation, maybe this is a chance to ask God to be my refuge and allow me to safely return. All kinds of cool opportunities for us to think and to consider, and of course, finally to pray, Psalm 61. Psalm 62 reminds me of one of my favorite statistics that I made up. 98% of North American evangelical male preachers who quote St. Augustine quote that famous line, "My heart is restless until it finds its rest in you." Now, I admitted right from the start that I just made that up, but I have a feeling it's true, and I do wonder if there's any intertextual connection between that great quote from St. Augustine that I like, and the opening lines of this evocative psalm, "My soul finds rest in God alone, my victory, my rescue, my deliverance comes from him, he alone's my rock, and my rescue, my fortress, and I won't be shaken." There's an interesting story in 2 Kings 18 where the Assyrian field commander utters threatening and intimidating. It's actually a war of the words, almost. But on Hezekiah's orders, the people of Jerusalem, the people on the wall, the people within earshot, you know what they do? They remain silent. Huh. Opening line, opening picture of Psalm 62, "For God alone, my soul waits in silence," is, I think, an interesting way to think about it. Of course, Robert Alter translates it a little differently. "Only in God is my being quiet." So it's more of the idea that only in the presence of God can I actually find peace. All these other sedatives, all these other self-medications, all these illusions of the world, really, my nephesh, my soul, my inner being, is only quiet, is only at peace in the presence of God. And so if there's this individual picture that begins the psalm, it ends with this corporate call to trust in the midst of a storm, with all the inevitable surges of temptation that come in the midst of a storm, in the midst of a citywide or even bigger crisis. I have no idea whether you can relate to the idea of people acting weird in times of crisis, but the poet of Psalm 62 seems to be acquainted with such primal elements of sinful, flawed, and degenerate human nature. At the halfway point of this podcast, are you feeling a little thirsty? Well, if so, then Psalm 63 is for you. Oh, my God. My soul thirsts for you, my body longs for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. Where is there almost a guarantee that you'll be thirsty? How about the desert of Judah? And behold, Psalm 63 superscription, that is the heading for Psalm 63, the desert of Judah. Now, it's interesting, Psalm 63, when David's in the desert of Judah, I suppose our natural default is to think, oh, well, that's during his fugitive period from Saul that we just talked about. Remember when agents surrounded the house and he escaped? Well, he fled into the desert, where he remained, of course, for years in a group of desperados who were disaffected from Saul and, frankly, racked up a fair bit of credit card debt, found a helpful ally in David. So this is surely a period when he was in the desert, but you know what? There's a handful of reputable and assiduous commentators that actually say, no, this is when David was in the desert that is outside of the capital city because he was forced to flee due to the uprising of Absalom. Now, we already have Psalm 3, but I think you could say that, there's nothing that is that discounts right off the bat the idea of a setting later in David's career rather than early. Now, again, the majority of commentators would go early, but some pretty smart ones opt for a later moment in David's career when he had to go in the desert again. Because this time, I mean, he's comparatively innocent, I think, in the fugitive period with Saul, but of course tremendously guilty, and the Absalom rebellion is in many respects self-inflicted. So I think you'd have to read the psalm and get more of the details of it, but the desert experience with its thirst, whether it's self-inflicted or not, I think we can probably all identify at various levels. As a good Canadian, you know what I would say? I would say keep every option open. Read the psalm a number of different ways and imagine different kinds of settings and put yourself in the poet's rather dry and dusty sandals. I mean, maybe the superscription's pointing us in a certain direction. Maybe, on the other hand, it's deliberately open-ended to speak to any period of life where we're arid and isolated. Maybe it's physical, maybe it's spiritual, some combination of both. What are we told to do in such crisis? The poet of this psalm is advising that we earnestly seek God rather than accept spiritual dehydration as our new normal. So, desert experiences, we can still find solace in the God who delivers and will help us to get through this dry and dusty period. You know, earlier in our discussions together, we were talking about Micaiah in 1 Kings 22. We were talking about the divine counsel, and here's Micaiah, who's having this vision, and yet he's surrounded by a crowd of sycophants from the age and from the court of Ahab, launching words at him like missiles. It's interesting that the poet of Psalm 64 kind of takes us into that kind of situation. Psalm 64, line 3, they sharpen their tongues like swords, aim their words like deadly arrows. They encourage each other in evil plans, talk about laying their snares fraught with injustice, and so forth. Now, I was curious about that story in 1 Kings 22. Have a look at it sometime. Ahab, despite the fact that he's the CEO of this kind of public shaming, can't avoid an arrow that is shot randomly by a soldier whose eyes are closed and who's looking in the complete wrong direction and just fires this arrow. It's almost like there's a divine guidance system that takes that arrow right between the joints of Ahab's armor. And I say that because line 7 of Psalm 64 says that God will shoot them with arrows. Suddenly they'll be struck down. He'll turn their own tongues against them and bring them to ruin. And all who see them will shake their heads in scorn. So this kind of retribution idea in Psalm 64, I think fits well with an intertext like 1 Kings 22 you can check out sometime. You know, sometimes you'll have a terrible week, just fraught with your own bad choices, with domestic anarchy, let's say. People at work are just, they've got sharpened arrows and they seem to be hitting you right in the, right in the neck, let's say. Utter misery has attended your week, and yet you come into the house of the Lord. There's a gifted worship leader, and there's a song that she is able to just evoke in your imagination an ideal picture of worship and God's kingship, and it literally takes you to a different place, takes you to a better place, takes you into the presence of our God and King. And I wonder if Psalm 65 doesn't have that kind of utility as we think of Jerusalem and all of its issues and all of its struggles, and yet we're told that the streams of God are filled with water to provide the people with grain, for so you have ordained it. I mean, just this bounteous harvest that God has provided. I mean, it's this move, isn't it? From the threatening, from the chaotic seas to this beneficent stream. I mean, it's just a marvelous moment, I think, where we have an ideal picture of what the Jerusalem temple and its monarchy could look like. Just like the best worship leaders can take us to a vision of our own lives with God and what it actually is like, because God has raised us up with Christ and seated us with him in heavenly places so that he can show the riches of his grace to the coming ages. And we need to be reminded of that in worship services. And Psalm 65, I think, is pointing to that sort of reality. And I suppose, just to continue with that illustration, if you're in that kind of worship service, you know it's authentic when you don't want it to end, okay? When you don't look at your watch, and a lot of my students don't have watches nowadays, they've got these, what are they called again? They're cyborgs, yeah. They're half human, half smartphone. Yeah, that's it. They look at their phone and they find the time. If they don't do that for more than, let's say, 30 seconds, I know they're enraptured and something in the power of the Holy Spirit's taken hold of them. Psalm 66 continues this worship service. The world's invited to consider the acts of God. The acts of God, we remember these great things that God's done for us, splitting the sea during the Exodus, drying up the Jordan, entering into the land of promise, our inheritance, that place that God has for us. We remember some of the great acts of deliverance, like maybe even the rescue from the Assyrians we were just talking about a second ago. I think Psalm 65 and 66 remind us that these were the kinds of songs that were performed in the temple. People could have heard them, and they really could have taken refuge and solace and lived according to these lyrics. So don't just think this is a rebuke on ancient Israel, but I wonder if it's a challenge to our contemporary worshiping communities as well. Now, in fairness, once the worship service does have to end, once the children's programs are over and these hyperactive little blessings are ready to come forth and greet everybody else, what happens? Well, you probably need something like a blessing, don't you, from the worship leader. You need a famous blessing, something like the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Remember that great blessing in Numbers chapter 6? Well, you wonder if Psalm 67 doesn't kind of give us some rhythm and news. Some commentators say that it's a prayer for the harvest, but at the same time a desire that all nations come to experience the beneficence of God. One interpreter says the psalm's an expression of Israel's calling to be a kingdom of priests and a light to the nations. And I guess the question that's asked in Psalm 67, is this a priority for the citizens of Jerusalem? By extension, is that a priority for our churches today? Speaking of worship services in the temple, Psalm 68 might be an example of one of these, kind of a Saturday night temple poetic sermon. It's long, it's hard to translate, and some commentators liken it to kind of a rolling psalm. In other words, there was verses and stanzas that were sort of added at various points, drawing in elements of Israel's tradition. And lest you say that's just kind of, redactional, critical nonsense, you know, pulling rabbits out of hats and just including all kinds of bits of tradition out of some sort of manic tribal compulsion. But before we say that, we should appreciate that a hymn like Amazing Grace has some extra lines that weren't necessarily original. When we've been, is it here or there? 10,000 years? I mean, that part was added by a later impresario. So there are rolling hymns, and you, frankly, have maybe, like, sung them, usually in the key of G, because that's 90% of Christian songs. But, you know, the idea of something that becomes this great event and is then publicly proclaimed may be an example of Psalm 68, which you can kind of envision being performed at a temple service. Maybe some of the young people, maybe hip-hoppy, you got Chris Tomlin in there, you got, Toby Mac, and that kind of thing. One commentator says that the topic concerns the entry of God into his sanctuary, using the background and the images of the conquest and the settlement of the land to the occupation of the city of Zion. And what this psalm does is traces God's triumphant march through the desert, his conquest over the kings of Canaan, and finally his ascension to the holy mountain to reign in majesty. Close to the end of book two, it's kind of curious. Jerusalem soon going to be invaded. Is this almost to prepare them for exile or to try to ward off the threat in their mind? You can think about that, but let's face it, we're getting close to the end of book two, and therefore close to the end of this podcast. Psalm 69, then, starts with a threatening image, the dark waters of chaos. Don't forget, ancient Israelites, they do not like water. They have this primordial fear. In the beginning, of course, what was it? The earth. It was tohu vabohu. It was formless and void. Dark waters that were turbulent and terrifying. Images of chaos. You gotta wonder then if Psalm 69 takes us to the nation on the precipice of exile. You wonder if the poet's mourning the loss of the temple or listening to the prophetic words of somebody like Jeremiah and mourning the imminent loss of the temple. Either way, you can kind of sense this chaotic momentum beginning to accumulate when you read the words of Psalm 69. If the nation is heading into exile, then there's going to be a sense of shame. And as a result, Psalm 70 seems to be within that bracket. Some similarities in the first instance with Psalm 40. Psalm 40, of course, right at the end of Book 1. Psalm 70, right at the end of Book 2. That's an interesting correspondence. You can glance at it yourself, but you wonder if near the end of the Book 2, this is a prelude to some dark days that are ahead. And even in the midst of those dark days, you have to wonder, is it possible to still live faithfully, even though everything's crumbling all around you? Even though civilization is going to Hades in a handbasket, can you still, nonetheless, live faithfully? And you wonder if Psalm 71 isn't that kind of prayer, isn't that kind of reflection? And maybe someone's resolving to teach their children differently as they head into exile, away from land and temple. Anyway, some call 71 kind of a prayer of old age that features reflection on the past and the present, but you can make your own judicious call as you glance through those particular lyrics. Last but not least, Psalm 72. My goodness. There's two psalms that have a Solomonic superscription, and this is number one. Now, go back to the last psalm in Book 1. It was almost the words of an aged king, sort of getting ready to, or perhaps giving advice to a successor, providing a vision of the king as a champion of justice and a defender of the faith. 42 kings of Israel and Judah each fell short in different ways and rarely came close to the beauty of Psalm 72 that some commentators imagine was prayed over every king in the temple. If that's the case, well, then this coronation hymn actually becomes kind of a funeral lament, a national requiem, if you will, and a tearful commentary on royal failure. Psalm 72. May you endow the king with your justice, O God. No king was interested in seeing that prayer answered, so to speak. And so what do we have? Look at the very, 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 very end of Psalm 72, because here the prayers of David, son of Jesse, are ended. That means the Davidic line, as far as institutionally reigning in Jerusalem, has come to an end, and there's going to be no more kings ever in the Davidic dynasty crowned with this particular prayer. No institutional king, no typical monarch. Oh, there will be a king later who comes with justice, who comes with equity, who comes with fairness for all. There will be a king who allows nations to be blessed and have us flourish. There's a king who will come and deliver the needy, but it's not going to be in the typical institutional sense. End of Psalm 72, therefore, end of Book 2. We'll look forward to talking about these things together. Meanwhile, thanks for listening, and richest of blessings as we continue our journey together.
In my wrestling and in my doubts, in my failures, you won't walk out. Your great love will lead me through. You are the peace in my troubled sea. Whoa, you are the peace in my troubled sea. Yeah. In the silence, you won't let go. In the questions, your truth will rule. Your great love will lead me through. You are the peace in my troubled sea. Whoa. You are the peace in my troubled sea, yeah. My lighthouse, my lighthouse, shining in the darkness, I will follow you. My lighthouse, my lighthouse, I will trust the promise, you will carry me safe to shore.
Carry me. Father, we come to you in every season. We trust you with our lives. You're the peace in our troubled sea. You're the fire before us, constant in the darkness. And you will lead us through the storms.
Fire before us, you're the brightest. You will lead us through the storms. Fire before us.